Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anise Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar welcomes Dr. Carrie Gross. Dr. Gross is Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of the Copper Center at Yale Cancer Center. Here's Anise Chagpar.
So why don't we start off by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and what copper is anyways?
So I'm a general internist or a primary care provider, and I'm a researcher here at Yale, and my primary area of interest is cancer and understanding how we can help patients make more informed decisions about cancer screening, about cancer treatment options, and basically to help generate new data that can inform decision making for both patients and for their doctors.
Terrific. And what is copper aside from a metal?
It's also an acronym for our center. So it stands for the Cancer Outcomes Policy and Effectiveness Research. But really, in plain English, what this outcomes or cancer outcomes research, what it really means is helping to understand how treatments or screening tests or anything we're doing to patients really affects them.
And so tell us a little bit more about the research that you're doing in copper and what are some of the interesting findings that are coming out? Because it would seem to me that you've got a tremendous resource in terms of looking at outcomes, but a really broad mandate as well.
Yeah, that's one of the challenges, is that there are many types of cancer and there are many new treatments that are being developed and being brought into clinical practice. So in our Copper Center, we have clinicians from a variety of specialties. We have surgeons, we have radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, other primary care docs. We also have health economists and a variety of other epidemiology and PhD specialists. But what we're really trying to focus on is understanding when new treatments or when new screening approaches are just starting to be used in practice, is that really helpful for patients? One of the challenges in our society, I think we have a very strong belief in our culture that new is better. Mm-hmm. We all want the shiny new thing. And if you look at the way we frequently are advertising, whether it's for laundry detergent, you know, new and free are the words that are most commonly used in advertising because they're highly effective. And my concern is the same thing can hold for cancer treatments. We're frequently advertising and we're frequently are speaking to patients about the new treatment, but we're not 100% sure it's really better than the tried and true therapies. So in the Copper Center, what we are doing is we're working on evaluating some of these new treatments. So let me give you one example of one type of treatment that we're looking at. So when women have early stage breast cancer, as you well know, Anise, as a breast surgeon, after the surgical treatment, one of the common approaches that the clinicians use to help to prevent the cancer from returning is radiation therapy. So after a woman has breast-conserving surgery and there's no visible cancer tumor remaining, the radiation can help to prevent the cancer from coming back again. And as you would imagine, over the course of the past 20, 30 years, as technology has progressed, there have been new and exciting developments in terms of how to deliver, how to treat with radiation. One of the new therapies is called breast brachytherapy, where instead of using beams to shoot radiation from outside of the patient, for brachytherapy, a small balloon catheter is placed inside the breast, and then the radiation is delivered internally inside the breast tissue around where the tumor was just removed from. And ideally, this makes a lot of sense. The breast brachytherapy requires a shorter duration of treatment than these external beams. It can be delivered in about a week, as opposed to coming back over 4 to 6 weeks of daily treatments like external beam therapy. But it wasn't really clear whether patients were receiving the same outcomes, because everybody would sign up for a shorter course of treatment. You know, who wouldn't want to have a only 1 week's worth of treatments versus 6 weeks? But the trade-off is, you want to know if it's better or not. I don't want to take a 1 week treatment if it's going to have a worse outcome than the 6 weeks treatment. So what we did is we accessed Medicare claims data. These are administrative claims. All of the patient identifying information has been stripped off of these records. So we're not actually looking at people's actual names or social security numbers or anything, but we do have their clinical information. So we know the type of cancer and the type of surgery they received, and who received this new breast brachytherapy, and who received the, again, this tried and true external beam therapy. And what we found, a couple of things. So first, we were just curious how often this new treatment was being used, because there is not a lot of data out there comparing new versus old treatment. But our first question was, how rapidly was this being adopted into clinical practice? And what we found, this is using data from 2008, 2009, we found that about 16% of women in the Medicare program who were receiving radiation therapy were getting this new brachytherapy. So, you know, about 1 out of 6 women now in the Medicare program were getting brachytherapy, even though the benefits are unclear. And then we looked at how the use of brachytherapy varied across the country. And what we found was that women living in some areas of the country were very unlikely to get brachytherapy. Basically, it just wasn't being used in some parts, depending where you live. But women living in some counties, some parts of the country, nearly 70% of women were getting brachytherapy. So for starters, there's a huge variation depending where you live that impacts whether you're getting this new and largely unproven treatment. We then looked at the outcome of treatment, and specifically we focused on the complication rate. We wanted to know, at least for the short term, did the likelihood of complications increase if you received brachytherapy? And what we found was that women who received breast brachytherapy had a significantly higher chance of a short-term complications. And these were not life-threatening complications. I don't mean to scare any of our listeners who might have had brachytherapy. These were local complications, like a wound infection, a need for an additional procedure to remove fluid. So the take-home point was that there was a higher complication rate, not necessarily a higher risk of, you know, of life-threatening complications. But for us, it's really raised the importance of doing more research to understand why these new treatments are being used and how can we generate more data to understand whether they're safe or effective.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about how things are marketed and new and free being the two key words, oftentimes new, at least when it comes to medical screening and treatments, is anything but free. And so have you looked at costs associated with newer screenings and newer treatments? And because particularly in this day and age, when we turn on the news every night and we hear about the fiscal cliff, and then we hear about sequestration, and then we hear about the Affordable Care Act, you know, it would seem to me that that kind of research is particularly important.
That's a great point. That even for people who have health insurance, often cancer can be financially really challenging because of high copays, because of lifetime limits on how much your insurance will pay. And in fact, some studies have shown that health-related costs are the number one cause of bankruptcy in our country. So when we're thinking about cancer costs, it's important to note that this is not only about the huge financial cost at the national level. I mean, we're now in the trillions of dollars per year that we're spending on healthcare in our country with very little to show for it. A recent publication by the Institute of Medicine, they looked at the healthcare costs across 17 industrialized countries. we're spending about twice as much per capita in the U.S. compared to other countries, and we're finished dead last in many indicators of health. So at the population level, we're spending a lot on health and cancer, but also at the individual, at the patient level, it can be very expensive and sometimes can be really debilitating to patients and to their families. So because of that, we in the Yale Copper Center have been focusing on looking at not only clinical outcomes but also looking at costs. And in one study, we looked at the use of new breast cancer screening modalities. I have a strong interest in women's health, hence this theme of breast cancer. So in again, this is the same theme of the tried and true as analogous to the radiation. There was this external beam therapy that was the tried and true that we compared to brachytherapy. Here for breast cancer screening, we looked at the traditional screening mammography. And then we wanted to see how newer approaches to breast cancer screening are diffusing into clinical practice and how has that affected the cost of breast cancer care. So there are different types of mammography now. There's digital mammography. They have this computer-aided detection, which can help the doctors to better see abnormal spots on a mammogram. We now have MRIs of the breast, which are sometimes being used for screening. But there's not a lot of evidence that these are superior to the existing tried-and-true mammograms, particularly for older women. So we use our Medicare data, and we assessed the use of these new screening modalities, and we also looked at the costs of care. And what we found was that in the Medicare program, we're spending a total of over $1 billion per year on breast cancer screening. And this was remarkable not only because the big B, billion, is a big number, but also because there's very little evidence that is guiding our decisions about who should be screened for breast cancer, particularly over the age of 65 or 70 years. So we're not really sure who should be screened. And when we are screening these patients, it's hard to know what's the best approach. So we decided that to then break down the country into geographic regions. Like as I mentioned, we have over $1 billion we're spending from the Medicare program on breast cancer screening. So we thought, why don't we look at which areas are spending more and which areas are spending less and compare the screening outcomes. Ideally, if you are getting your money's worth, if you're spending more on screening, women living in those geographic regions would be perhaps having a lower likelihood of being diagnosed with a metastatic cancer. Because ideally, the whole point of screening is you want to catch your cancer early, treat it early before it can spread and become what we call metastatic disease. So when we compared different areas of the country, we looked at the high-spending areas. These are places where they're spending twice as much on screening older patients for breast cancer. And we found they're no less likely to be diagnosed with a metastatic disease in those areas. So we're spending more, but we're not necessarily getting better screening outcomes. So for me, this really underscored the importance of really understanding how are we going to generate evidence that can help patients to make informed decisions. Again, we don't want to say don't screen. What we want to be able to do is tell patients, you know, here, these are the risks and benefits for you. You know, for someone like you, someone, if you're a 75-year-old woman with a history of heart failure and you're a sister and three sisters had breast cancer, for somebody like you, these are the tests that we think are the most helpful. And these are the risks and benefits. And right now, we just don't have the evidence to do that yet.
So, I mean, it sounds like you're moving towards more personalized approaches to really assessing outcomes and costs in a meaningful way. We're going to talk more about that after we take a short break for a Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about how we can decrease the burden of cancer with Dr. Carrie Gross.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is new hope. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Carrie Gross. We're discussing decreasing the burden of cancer, and right before the break, Carrie, you were talking about the wonderful research that you're doing that's really focused on improving outcomes, reducing costs by taking a very critical look at how we screen and treat cancers. And so one of the things that struck me as we were talking, and you were talking about breast cancer screening and whether in fact there is value in terms of using these newer modalities, particularly in older women, was the whole United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendations that came out that also tried to look at where the evidence was to get the maximum bang for your buck and how there really was a lot of public outcry about reducing screening. How do you feel about that?
That's a great question, because we certainly don't want to reduce access to tests that are effective. We don't even want to reduce access to tests that are probably effective. But what we do want to do is we want to determine, using rigorous evidence, which tests or which treatments are definitely not effective, and then tell people you shouldn't be getting these tests. Nobody wants to ration care. But on the other hand, no patient wants to get a treatment or a test that's not helpful for them. So I think the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force misstepped when they phrased their recommendations for women in their 40s when they said they should not be routinely getting screening mammography. I mean, I think what they really meant was don't routinely, in the sense of do it all the time without thinking about it, like that type of a routine, like brushing your teeth. But the way it was interpreted was nobody should be getting mammograms in their 40s. And I think what we should be telling our patients in their 40s is to really understand the benefits and risks of mammography and talk about them with your doctors.
Yeah. And I suppose that the same thing applies to people in older age groups as well, that, you know, somebody who is 90, who may be, you know, running 5 miles a day and, you know, playing tennis on the weekends and has an expected life of another 20, 30 years, maybe, may actually want and benefit from tests more than, say, somebody who is 50, who is on dialysis and has coronary artery disease and end-stage liver failure.
Absolutely. And it's a challenge because one of the important factors that influences whether cancer screening will be helpful is your life expectancy. But then predicting life expectancy is not so easy. It's two things that make this a challenge. One, predicting is hard, especially about the future, that sort of Yogi Berra quote. But the second aspect is that even if we did have really good instruments that can help us predict life expectancy, they're also tough conversations to have. I mean, a lot of doctors and patients don't feel comfortable talking about what may be a shorter life expectancy. And that's one aspect of our culture that I think we as a country need to get over. This hesitancy of talking about death, talking about end of life, or even, again, if it's life expectancy, even if you're talking to someone and their life expectancy is less than 10 years, that's certainly not the end of life. But it should affect the way you're making decisions. Maybe, undergoing a test that may not benefit you until 10 years from now, you shouldn't do that test. So I think what we need as far as counseling older patients about screening are better tools to predict life expectancy, but also more training of providers, more training of physicians and nurse practitioners, so we feel comfortable speaking to patients about these tough issues so they can really make informed choices.
Yeah, and I guess the other tough topic to talk about is that all of those new technologies that you refer to, the MRIs and the latest, greatest, newest technology, many of them are embraced because they can find small cancers, they can find precancers, but some people have talked about this as being overdiagnosis. And so how do you know when a diagnosis is a diagnosis and when a diagnosis might be an overdiagnosis and when tests are appropriate and when tests are just really sensitive?
That's a great question. As our technology has progressed, we can find smaller and smaller and smaller things inside the body, smaller tumors, many of which may not go on to cause any problem. Now, we've known about this for prostate cancer for a long time. There are many men who have early stage prostate cancer that has a very favorable tumor characteristics. And for many of these men, they're not likely to see any health consequences of that tumor. What we say is they're more likely to die with their cancer than from their cancer. But what we're recognizing more recently is the same phenomena might be occurring for other cancer types. There's a recent study looking at breast cancer, and they looked at the 30 years worth of mammography or screening data, and they also looked at trends in the diagnosis of cancers. And again, if you think about screening, if you screen more for a particular cancer type, the idea is if screening's really effective, you would be catching more early stage cancers. But by catching more early stage, the whole point is you're preventing the late stage cancers. So if you're doing more screening, eventually, again, this is at the population level, you should be finding higher numbers of early stage, lower numbers of late stage. But what these investigators found is as the mammography use really grew in over a 30-year period, what they found is there was a tremendous increase in early-stage cancers, but there was actually a very, very small decrease in late-stage. Basically, they added up all the early-stage cancers they found. There are more than a million additional early-stage cancers that were not accounted for by a decrease in late-stage cancers. So that suggests that at the population level, as we're doing more and more and more screening, we're finding, again, this is over 30 years, but we're finding more than a million extra breast cancers, but we're not necessarily decreasing the late stage. Now, the real challenge is to take that information and use it to inform your decisions. So that doesn't mean that mammography is not effective, because many studies have shown it is effective and it can save lives. But on the other hand, these data show that some of the cancers that are being picked up may not go on to cause the patient any harm. And here's where the evidence comes to a grinding halt. We're not really sure how to tell which cancers are going to cause problems and which ones aren't. So again, what we really need to do is figure out how can we prognosticate for a woman with a very small, newly diagnosed cancer, particularly a woman who might be older and have a lot of other health problems, whether she really needs to go on and get chemotherapy or surgery, or maybe that particular tumor is one of those very benign ones, one of those ones we call an overdiagnosed tumor.
Yeah, so because one would think that not only does that have cost implications for the entire system, treating people who probably wouldn't need that treatment because the outcomes would be no different, and would have fundamental human costs as well in terms of giving people treatments with side effects that they didn't necessarily need to have.
Absolutely. And in addition to the treatment-related consequences, just the emotional toll of all of a sudden, boom, you have cancer. You're a cancer survivor. And if that information actually doesn't benefit somebody, then it's hard to make an argument for digging to find it out in the first place. We're at a fascinating time in our healthcare system because our technology is outpacing our ability to interpret the findings. One more interesting note about some of these imaging tests, like CAT scans, is that they do involve radiation, and by some counts, the radiation that is being delivered to patients, I'm not speaking about mammograms here, but just generally in the use of CAT scans in the medical field, we may be delivering so much radiation that we're causing 20 or 30,000 cancers per year, just by exposing people to the CAT scans. So the irony, as we're doing more looking for cancers, we may actually be causing more cancers. So again, this is just an argument for thinking about being careful about how we're using this new technology and understanding the risks as well as the benefits.
So it sounds like it is indeed a very interesting time. So where do we take the research from here? How do we start answering some of those questions of who really needs to be screened and how? How do we personalize that treatment? We talk a lot on this show about personalized therapies, and I think that plays in here as well in terms of personalized screening potentially, or figuring out who's going to get the most benefit and which cancers are overdiagnosed and which ones aren't. So where does the research go from here?
So we're at the cusp of a new new generation of health-related research. As I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I've been using Medicare claims data, which are really useful, but that's nothing compared to actual patient-reported outcome data. What we really need to do is link all these different sources of information together. We need to know for each patient how they're being treated, what type of cancer they have, or if we're talking about screening, what other health problems they have or cancer risk factors, and tie that into the patient-reported outcomes. So ideally, when a patient presents to either their primary care doctor or to their breast surgeon, they should be completing these very brief focused questionnaires about their health status that should be integrated with their electronic medical record data. And the healthcare system, as we're seeing patients, should really be thought of as a giant database. So as patients are progressing through the healthcare system, they're generating new data that can then be studied to help to determine people's health choices, and to determine which treatments are going to be most effective for them.
So do you think that we will come to a day when, you know, Mrs. Jones goes to the doctor and has put in all of her patient-reported outcome information, and there will be an algorithm in a computer somewhere that says, Mrs. Jones, you don't need a mammogram, but Mrs. Smith over here, you do?
Well, ideally, we want the patients to be in the driver's seat. So my vision would be to say, Mrs. Jones, for women like you, because you are, say, 90 years old and have severe health problems, there's probably a 1 in 10,000 chance a mammogram is going to help you. However, there's a 1 in 20 chance you'll end up needing a biopsy, and you may end up being a 1 in 50 chance that you'll have a cancer diagnosed that really wouldn't have caused you problems in the first place. I'm making all those numbers up, obviously. But then similarly, for a different patient, you'd give really tailored data so they could use that data to inform their decision making. So my hope is that we're moving toward generating data that will inform their decisions, but not be too strict about how those data are being used.
Yeah. And you would wonder, too, whether as we, you know, think about overdiagnosis, particularly in fields like breast cancer, whether we will enter an era that will be more like what we've seen as the evolution in terms of prostate cancer, where some men with prostate cancer have this period of watchful surveillance, where instead of having the surgery and the radiation, are simply followed.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to think about the fact that watchful waiting or surveillance for prostate cancer is an accepted treatment. And for other types of cancer, people would cringe at that idea. And partly because we don't have enough experience with those other cancer types to do that. But it's something to start exploring which patients need treatment and which patients might benefit from other modalities or other approaches.
Dr. Carrie Gross is Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of the Copper Center at Yale Cancer Center. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.